Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc forum called At It Again, A Second Google Antitrust Verdict. Speaking with us today, we're very pleased to have Professor Rebecca Haugh-Allensworth, Bilal Sayed, and Joel Thayer. And we're thankful to Ashish Agarwal for moderating this program today. Ashish is a consultant for the American Edge Project and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. And throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, you can enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Ashish, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Well, thank you, Edie, and thank you to the Federalist Society and the Corporations and Antitrust Practice Group and our chair, Svetlana Gans, for helping us put all this together. 2 weeks ago, a federal court found that Google violated Section 2 of the Sherman Act by willfully acquiring and maintaining monopoly power in the open web display publisher ad server market and the open web display ad exchange market, though the court ruled in Google's favor in determining that there is not a relevant market for open web display advertising ad networks. The case is now moving into a remedies phase, and the court's lengthy opinion could affect several other pending tech cases and antitrust law generally. Today, we have an outstanding panel to discuss these issues. Professor Allensworth is a law professor at Vanderbilt, where she studies antitrust, professional licensing, and evolving attitudes towards tech platforms. Bilal Sayed is in private practice at Cadwalader, an adjunct professor at the Scalia Law School, and the host of a very popular podcast, Rethinking Antitrust. In President Trump's first term, Bilal led the FTC's Office of Policy Planning. And finally, we have Joel Thayer, who is the president of the Digital Progress Institute and the founder of his own law firm, Thayer PLLC. And Joel is an alumnus of both the FTC and the FCC, and a very famous personage in antitrust law in recent weeks. Sadly, Adam Kovacevic with the Chamber of Progress had to cancel at the last minute. And in light of that, we're going to implement presidential debate moderator rules, so I might press our panelists a little more than I might otherwise. All right. With that, let's get to it. And Rebecca, let's start with you. For those who haven't been tracking this case very closely, could you give us an overview of the complaint and the court's holding and maybe touch upon why this case has gotten so much less attention, seemingly, than the Google search case?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer those questions. So this case was filed by the DOJ alleging that Google monopolized the ad tech market. Now, I think skipping ahead to one of your last questions, part of why this has gotten less attention is because this market is opaque to us. You know, you could think about it like the energy market or the electricity market or maybe water. You know, it's like the internal plumbing or electric connections that take, on the one hand, an advertisement that somebody wants to put on the web and puts it through the market, through various exchanges and various processes, to a website that wants to host it. So it's just very complicated and unfamiliar to us. And so we're going to try to break it down. I'll try to break it down as simply as I can. But part of why it hasn't gotten as much attention really is this sort of unfamiliarity and complexity with the idea. Contrast that to the search case, which is very familiar to us because we use search as a product all the time. It's just such a huge part of our lives. Now, digital advertising actually is, and if we don't, we may not realize it, but it actually is a huge part of our lives because it is the way that most websites are able to offer free content. So, you know, every time you go to look up a recipe or you go to look up an article, you're scrolling through and you're going to see these ads pop up. And sometimes they take a second. You'll notice there's like a blank space as you're reading. And then 1 second later, it'll be like a car ad. Okay, so that in that half a second, in that fraction of a second, a whole bunch of transactions are happening behind the scenes within what we call the ad tech stack. And it essentially looks like this. You have a buyer side, that would be the advertisers. So here we're going to put, you know, Chrysler, J. Crew. Okay. They have a campaign. They want to push out their ads to the open web. That's the buyer side. Then in the middle, you have the exchange. You could think about this like the New York Stock Exchange, where buyers of stocks and sellers of stocks come together to actually conduct the transaction. And then the other side is you have the publishers. So that would be the New York Times website or the recipes.com website that's selling that blank space that has my eyeballs in on it for a split second. The DOJ claimed that Google monopolized three different parts of this stack. They said, and now I have to see, this is so complicated, I have to consult my notes. Handily, the decision comes with a nice graphic that will help us. So on the ad side, on the advertiser side, Chrysler, J. Crew, they claimed that the advertiser-facing ad network was a market and that Google monopolized it. They also claimed on the publisher side that the ad server product, which was where advertisers went to, describe and offer their empty spots. And this is, you may be familiar with the company DoubleClick. This was the DoubleClick for publishers is Google's product in this space. They said they monopolized that market. And then finally, they monopolized the thing in between, which is the ad exchange, which in the case of Google is a product called AdX. So the idea here was, simply put, Google had this market power because of search. And that was, everybody wanted to advertise on Google search. Basically, if you were Chrysler, you were J.Crew, you wanted to pop up in those first few answers to the query on Google search. And so Google had this tremendous advertiser demand and all these relationships with advertisers that it could use to make a product called AdWords. This is the first step in the stack, which is an ad network, and have a lot of market power there. Then the allegation was that it used that product and that access to all the advertiser demand. It leveraged that power into the publisher side. It basically said to the New York Times, the publisher, look, if you want access to all these advertisers who are willing to pay a ton of money, I have them all on AdWords, and so I can give you access to this. And so monopolized that market for publisher ad servers. They alleged that the acquisition of DoubleClick, which happened in the, I can't remember if it's the late aughts or early, maybe it was like 2010 or something, was a part of, no, it was earlier than that, I think. Anyway, was a part of this monopolization. So the acquisition of DoubleClick was a part of that. And then finally, Google sort of discriminated against certain kinds of buyers and imposed a tie between their DoubleClick for publisher side thing and use of their exchange in order to monopolize the exchange. So essentially they said, first they said, if you want access to all these advertisers, you're going to have to use our publisher side ad server and you're going to have to use our exchange, tying essentially the exchange to the ad server. And those are the allegations. And the verdict decided that there was a market. So, of course, in monopolization, you have to have a well-defined market over which you have monopoly power. The court rejected one of the three market definitions offered by the government. The government said that ad networks are a market, and the judge said no. So essentially rejected that advertiser side monopolization claim, but did accept the government's market definition for ad exchange being something of its own market in which Google had market power, and the idea that this publisher ad server market is its own market and that Google had market power. Now, I don't want to get into the details of how the government made those arguments unless you'd like me to do that now, but I'm trying to give a sort of a brief overview. So it said there is no market for ad networks. There is a market for the exchange, and there is a market for the publisher ad server, which is basically DoubleClick for publishers. And there was monopolization based on exclusionary conduct. First, the tie between the ad exchange and the ads, the publisher ad server. So by telling the New York Times and recipes.com, you basically have to use our ad exchange. That tie was unlawful, uses the Jefferson Parish test for that. And it says that certain contractual terms that Google put in its ad server, DoubleClick terms, saying that, you know, you have to really privilege our ad exchange called First Look and Last Look, that harmed the competition in the exchanges and ultimately harmed the publisher ad server market, were also bad acts. So that those were exclusionary acts. And that is an overview of the case. I really welcome in other panelists to help me sharpen this because it is very complicated, but that's my understanding of the case.
Well, really appreciate that excellent summary in just a few minutes of a very complicated case. So, Bilal, let's dive in a little bit. And I wanted to ask you in particular about one of Google's primary defenses, which was to raise the American Express case from the Supreme Court. And to, you know, Google sort of makes this, presents this view that, gosh, this is a two-sided market and you advertisers are just looking for the most bang for their buck, you know, across the internet. And this market should be interpreted very broadly. The court took, you know, a much narrower view of Amex. I'm wondering if you can share, you know, your opinion of how the court analyzed that case.
All right. Thanks, Ashish. So I think this is an area where the district court's decision is vulnerable, right? I think. I'm not saying they got it wrong, at least I'm not saying that yet, but I think they're vulnerable on this question. Now, they clearly, I think this is right, they clearly define the ad exchange market as a two-sided market, right? But they then identified, you know, separate markets for I'll call sellers and buyers on either side of that ad exchange platform. And that seems not only counterintuitive, but wrong in the analysis, right? I think what you would take from Amex is that if you've identified a two-sided market, right? Ad exchange is a platform, the district court recognized it as a two-sided market. I think then in evaluating the competitive effects of conduct on one side or the other of the ad exchange, which would be the publisher ad server and the ad network, you need to take account of the effects on both sides from conduct on one side. And so this, I think, ties into Google's effort to say this is an ecosystem and should have been evaluated in a sense collectively. The conduct should have been evaluated collectively. So I think this is an area where the court, in recognizing the exchange as a two-sided market, two-sided platform, which is correct, then made a mistake in not evaluating the competitive effects of the restrictions that DOJ alleged Google had adopted for either the publisher side or the advertising side. So I think it muddled up, I think the court, district court here, muddled up the teaching of Amex, right? And it's not that you can't have separate markets on the side, on the other side of a on each side of the platform, right? Or that they can't be their own relevant markets. But when you're thinking about the competitive effects of conduct on one side or the other of a two-sided, let's say two-sided platform, you don't get to ignore the effect on, you know, one side to just evaluate the harm on the other. And that's what tripped up DOJ in Amex or the states, right? Both states and DOJ in Amex. They looked at the effects on only one side of you know, the network, so to speak. So it's I think the decision is vulnerable here.
Joel, would love your thoughts on that Amex analysis. And as you're answering, if you don't mind, I'd love to ask you about another important precedent that the court also discussed, which was Trinco and the duty to deal. You know, the court, you know, basically agreed that Google can do business with whom it chooses, but found that Google had sacrificed profits to make life a little more difficult for competitors. Can you talk about your views of whether the court got it right or wrong in terms of its Amex and Trinco analysis?
Happy to. I, for the record, I take the full endorsement of being a very famous person for the past few weeks. So thank you, Ashish. My initial reaction to Bilal's comments and also even reading our first impression of reading the case with respect to Amex is that I think that the analysis only makes sense if you're evaluating it through the tie and what the actual effects are. So it seems to me that the court was really interested in defining very key markets, as Rebecca very nicely outlined, where the publisher side of things happened to be a one-sided market. And the question was, does their monopolization of that one-sided market force the ecosystem into their ad exchange? And so I don't think that the court was actually trying to clarify anything in the Amex. That's at least my read. I don't think they actually needed to even go the Amex route if you're just trying to demonstrate that there's a Section 1 or 2 violation with respect to the tie. So I also will admit that I, among a lot of others, are very confused by the Amex decision and, you know, how, and I don't know if there's a clear path in discerning, you know, when the court is going to make certain characterizations as a two-sided market. I think that's still a hotly contested question. We saw that play out very publicly in the Epic v. Apple case, where there was this push and pull from the Ninth Circuit, where it wasn't really clear to the court that you needed equal effects on both sides of the market in order to have an antitrust harm. Only a mere effect might be something to get you over the line. But again, I think this is where we're seeing this get litigated in real time almost. And especially now we're having these court cases that deal with very complicated and vertically integrated markets like the ad markets, or like the digital ad markets, the app store markets. All of these are, I think that is my read of the ad tech case in particular, just to sum up, is that they were trying to not necessarily sidestep, but just say, look, we considered it. We looked at the Amex decision. We don't think we actually have to go there because we think that the DOJ has met their burden by virtue of the tie with respect to its one-sided market. We don't need to evaluate further on Amex. That was my personal read, and I think Bilal is correct that, you know, there will be a lot of debate and discussion around that particular strategy, and I do think that it makes some sense if you're looking at it within the context of the tie. On to the question of Trinco. I mean, So I think the defense bar at the antitrust in the antitrust world is forever the Gretchen Wiener of and where they're always trying to make fetch happen. And it seems like there is a natural penchant. Look, if I'm on the defense side too, I want everything to be a duty to deal case. I mean, the facts are good if you can get the court there. But the problem I think that occurred in this case is that there were just too many distinctions. And so just to be clear, Trinco was very much considered. I mean, there's a whole healthy portion of, I would say a significant portion of the decision related back to Trinco to outline the specific distinctions between this instance and what happened in Trinco. And so just so everyone is aware, the underarching ruling in Trinco is that the possession of monopoly power will not be found unlawful unless it's accompanied by an element of an anti-competitive conduct. So the question is, what is that anti-competitive conduct? Even when Justice Scalia was thinking through the Trinco case, he evaluated not just simply what was the specific antitrust statutes alleged, but also the giant the ecosystem at large. These were highly regulated markets. We were talking about Verizon. And Ashish, I know you and I go back on to the telecom days where you have like ILEX versus CLEX and like and the regulatory kerfuffle that occurs through there. And so Scalia, being a telecom lawyer himself, was evaluating that and saying, look, we already have the Telecom Act that essentially requires these forced integrations and forced dealings. You don't need an extra oomph from like the antitrust side to further encourage this quote unquote duty to deal. And so I think that really did bite Google in the butt a little bit on this issue, because one, you can make a clear distinction there, and the court actually goes out of its way to say that one, we're talking about a virtually unregulated entity. Whether you agree with that characterization is a discussion for another day, but that's how the court initially made its first distinction. The other distinction is that the duty to deal is separate and apart from a tying arrangement. So if you're looking at it from the context of a tie, then you don't necessarily need to go to the duty of the deal analysis at all, unless you want to say that all ties are de facto duty to deal cases, which I think there's a lot of problems with that analysis. I mean, to start, the Clayton Act identifies tying as an independent antitrust harm. So I just don't think you can get there. I think also there was just factual evidence that worked very much against Google in this case. And even if you wanted to take the Trinco case directly and say, look, even if you don't want to directly categorize as a duty to deal, that's fine. But here's the other, or also raise the issue of even within the note, I guess that you can call them exceptions, but generally the outlines that Scalia had, he listed three specific things that would get you out of harm's way and duty to deal specifically, was something offered to the public, was something that was originally offered to the public, not offered to a competitor, might be something that you would evaluate. This may have happened here. The distinction there with respect to Verizon was that the duty to deal in the Verizon context existed, and I'm quoting here from Justice Scalia, only existed within the bowels of Verizon. It was never actually offered to the public in the first place. That I think was very much distinguished with Google, because it was based, most of the things that we're talking about here were based off of acquisitions that happened after, meaning that the public did have access to this and there were certain things that they could avail themselves to pre-merger or acquisition, and now they're not able to. I think that also gets you a little bit, it gets you a little further out of the duty to deal type of arrangement. And I think that you're seeing courts get very skeptical of the duty to deal claims. I mean, I think we also saw that in Live Action or Live Nation, excuse me, where there was a similar type of argument going back and forth with respect to duty to deal, and the courts saying unequivocally, no, this isn't a get out of jail free card. You're going to actually have to demonstrate why this is a more akin to Trinco. And I think the facts in Trinco make it very hard for these tech companies in particular to try to put them in, square that circle. So those are my two cents. But I think that the court really did a fairly decent job of explaining why Trinco just isn't there. I think it really was to embolden the tie aspects of the case. So I hope that's helpful. I hope it wasn't muddled, but happy to respond.
Very helpful. Rebecca, would love your thoughts on the Amex analysis, the Trinco analysis. And if that wasn't enough, let me introduce another key part of the court's holding, which you and Joel touched upon, which was the court's merger analysis. The court, as you said, did find that there was not an anti-competitive problem when Google purchased DoubleClick or AdTech or the other company. In so finding, it relied heavily on the fact that DOJ had reviewed and not raised objection to those acquisitions at the time. So I'm just wondering what broader implications that part of the court's holding might have, for other pending cases, including, the Meta case. So there's a lot there. So Rebecca, pick and choose what you'd like to talk about.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a lot there's a lot to say about it. So American Express cannot mean what it says. It doesn't make any sense. And this poses a problem whether you are a free marketer and, you consider yourself a libertarian, whether you're right wing, whether you're left wing, whether you're neo-Brandeisian. American Express is a problem. And that's because it has this idea that, you know, the transaction platform, you have to consider both sides of the market. So the reason why we define markets is for one of two reasons, at least in a monopolization case. The first is to figure out whether or not this company has power. Are they able to essentially, you know, raise price profitably on their customers? And whether that's price or whether it's, you know, lower quality or whatever, it doesn't matter. But the idea is you're able to do something bad to consumers without the consequences that we associate with competition, without people being able to switch away. So under this definition, under this use of market definition, doesn't make any sense to think about the middle transaction where it's happening. Because the question is, as a merchant, does that company have power? Does American Express, or in this case, does Google have power to make terms worse for you, leaving you with nothing better to do? Now, the insight from the early 2000s from economists and two-sided markets that gets distorted in Amex is that that power to raise price on merchants or to raise price, let's say, on the publishers, so the New York Times or whatever, to make poor terms for them to be selling their advertising, that power is influenced in a two-sided market by the other side. Now, that's because, you know, you can't raise price too high. You can't screw over one side too badly if it means it unravels your interest from the other side. So this economic insight that's really meaningful, really important, got distorted into something incorrect, which is there's no such thing as a market on one side. What the economists were trying to say is power in that market on one side needs to account for what happens over here in this other market as well. That's not the same thing as saying there is no separate markets and there's no separate market definition. You absolutely can have power on one side of your two-sided market in a way that harms consumers and meets all of the statutory and case law definitions of how we have been thinking about market power forever. Okay, so that's one way in which American Express went wrong. And by the way, I'm going to try to keep my comments on American Express brief because they're multitude. The other reason why you define a market in a monopolization case is to locate the harm, is to say, here's where the effects are. If Amex is to be read to mean that you can take effects on one side of the market and balance them against effects from another, then this runs afoul of something we have had for essentially the entire history of the Sherman Act, which is you are not allowed to use effects in one market to offset effects in another. This is true in the 60s in a merger case, the bank merger case, Philadelphia National Bank. You can't say, look, we kind of screwed over the consumers in Philadelphia, but it was really because that made us a bigger player in New York. Now, you can see how left-wing people, right-wing people would be offended by this, right? Well, you know, the right-wing people may be offended by arguments that say, well, yeah, we kind of screwed over buyers of cars, but we really improved the environment. Or, you know, you cannot justify harming one market by harming another market. Okay, so given that American Express not only is like sort of contravenes all of antitrust policy, but also just internally incoherent, it's very unclear what it means going forward. And I would posit that what it means is what lower courts say it means. And so when we read this opinion, we are getting a sense of what Amex is going to be in practice. And I think what the lower court did here makes a lot of sense. First, she says, We cannot treat this as a single market because the one side is not a substitute for the other. That is true. That is what Amex should have said. The problem, and I will say that Bilal is correct, this is vulnerable, right? The problem is that's not what Amex says. Amex doesn't say that you're supposed to figure out whether the right side and the left side are substitutes. That would be the correct way of thinking about whether or not it's a market, but it's not what Amex does. So will that get reversed? Possibly. But I think that that's the correct thing to say, and I think that she handles it well in that sense. The other thing she says is that this is not a transaction platform. Again, a little bit unclear what that means, given that transactions are happening between advertising sellers and advertising buyers at the exchange level. How is that different? Maybe what American Express meant, or what we can now read it as, is limited to payment systems, where like there's literally just you're just paying. That's what a transaction is. So For us to have a workable antitrust going forward, we are either going to have to write around Amex or we're going to have to reverse Amex. Amex cannot stand for its most extreme and most literal reading. And I think that this opinion needs to be read in light of that. Okay, Trinco's a little bit different. Trinco's different because Trinco's a case that internally is coherent. Okay, you may love it or hate it. It doesn't have these kinds of problems, but it has a ton of dicta. It has all this stuff in there about we have to give people monopoly prizes, otherwise we disincentivize innovation. You can't be asked to reach into the bowels to, you know, and so what will we do with this precedent that has contributed to a sort of turn in antitrust law away from liability, especially away from liability for tech platforms that's now unpopular? Well, one thing we could do is we could start cutting away at some of the dicta and putting Trinco in its place by including only the things that are essential to the holding. And I think that that's what the judge does here. Now, is this vulnerable to reversal? Of course, because if you get a court that likes the dicta in Trinco, then maybe they'll say this runs afoul of Trinco. But what the court does here is it says that Trinco is not a license to just always deal, you know, you can refuse to deal with anybody you'd like. Trinco distinguishes Aspen Skiing in this way that can't be distinguished here. So the court in the ad tech case kind of embraces Aspen Skiing, puts this case more in the Aspen Skiing bucket than the Trinco bucket. And in particular, distinguishes Trinco as being in a highly regulated industry where the refusal to deal was actually required by statute, okay? And so there's a question there about like reaching into the bowels, right? This wasn't available on the market. This was an artificial act of Congress. And the other is the profit sacrifice. The court here says, I do see a profit sacrifice, like in Aspen Skiing, that wasn't present in Trinco. So that's my two cents about whether or not these distinctions that the court does of Amex and Trinco will hold up. But I will say that they are both crucial to the project of having a reasonable antitrust enforcement, especially against platforms. And finally,
appreciate all that. Let me let Bilal respond to the Amex and Trinco discussion. Then we'll come back to you first for mergers and some other topics.
Absolutely.
Bilal, you get the last word on Amex and Trinco.
Well, I think what I tried to say was the decision was vulnerable because I think it does deviate from the framework in Amex. Other courts may develop Amex differently. And I have the same view on the reliance or not on Trinco here. I mean, I think in both cases, the district court interpreted, whether it's Trinco, whether it's Amex, in ways that higher courts may not agree. And you know, that it may be that the doctrine is muddled, but it may be in unmuddling it, the higher courts tend more towards, you know, what I call existing Supreme Court law than developing district court law. And look, I think it's a tough matter. So I never like to criticize district court judges. You know, they deal with a lot of facts and they deal with all the questions. They have to make sense of them. But every time I read a district court opinion, I remember what Joe Catan said to me when I was, in fact, still a law student working with Joe Catan. He asked me to do some research for him on a point, and I brought him back, you know, a memo that relied heavily on district court cases and very little on appellate court cases. And he said, Bilal, he said, don't cite district court cases to me. He said, they get it wrong all the time. So, you know, I think and this is not a criticism, Rebecca, of you, I agree that Amex and Trinco, you know, in the right cases, sort of narrow application of the antitrust laws, you know, for a plaintiff. But district courts don't generally get to overturn Supreme Court doctrine. And I think, you know, in both cases, she, I don't know if you say either underreads or overreads those decisions and embarks on a path of interpreting them that strikes me as very vulnerable to reversal. Doesn't mean reversal and, well, it's sort of reversal and remand, basically, to rethink it. Which I think would be a killer for both. And I think that's also true. The search case would be a killer for DOJ's case in both, if they have to go back, you know, if the district court has to write another opinion, which is more narrowly interprets, you know, appellate or Supreme Court law. So that, you know, that I think is, you know, worth considering. I mean, it you know, Amex has been criticized. When I was at the FTC in the Trump administration, Amex came down. We were very concerned about how broadly it could be read. And so, you know, tried to read it narrowly. But what the court has done here, I think just there are a lot of questions about whether she got it right. And I just think it makes it vulnerable going up. But that's all.
All right, Rebecca, let's get back to another key part of the decision, you know, on the merger question and the court's basically, you know, blessing of those two acquisitions and relying heavily on the fact that DOJ raised no objections initially. Your thoughts on that part of the opinion and what it might mean for the Meta case. And then Joel, after that, I'd love to come to you to start talking about remedies. Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah, so, you know, I think district court judges love to split the baby. I think that that's a strategy for appearing to be sort of, you know, even-handed. And here she chose to not find in favor of the government on one of the market definitions, as I mentioned, and also on this idea that the acquisition of DoubleClick was anti-competitive. I don't know how much we can read into this as it pertains to the Meta case. So she takes a lot of pains to distinguish it from the Meta case. So as you point out, one of the similarities is that the regulator at the time declined the opportunity to challenge the merger, which is a little different from blessing the merger, but you know, they failed to move forward. And but there's some different dissimilarities. She says that at the time, Google was not a monopolist in this market, which was true when it acquired DoubleClick. That's very different for the Meta case. Meta was, you know, Facebook was a monopolist at the time in terms of market share, perhaps even more so than they are now. And that's one big difference. And then she also says that there's no evidence that they that Google acquired these companies in order to kill them, in order to shut them down. Well, I think that, you know, obviously Meta disputes this, but there's a lot of proof being offered at the trial right now that Facebook did acquire Instagram to shut it down or to at least throttle it in a way that, you know, would suppress competition. Similarly, with the way that it has used WhatsApp in a way to sort of prevent these things from really fully developing into head-to-head competitors with Facebook. So I think that, you know, I just would be hesitant to read too much into that. And I just think that they're different cases. But of course, yes, there's an echo here between that case and the Facebook, between this ad tech case and the Facebook case.
Joel, you know, welcome your comments on that kind of merger analysis. But I did want to make sure that we turn and talk a little bit about remedies. And Joel, really welcome your perspective on, you know, what kind of remedies would you expect the Department of Justice, you know, to propose here? And might that include a divestiture, you know, despite the loss on the merger part of the case? And I guess I should note, you know, as part of this question, that of course it's, you know, the President's Justice Department, and he has obviously times been very critical of the tech companies. He's been a little kinder recently. During the campaign, he was asked specifically whether Google should be broken up, and he said, you know, quote, "If you do that, are you going to destroy the company? What can you do without breaking it up to make sure it's more fair?" So, with that backdrop, Joel, welcome your thoughts.
What a backdrop. So, to start on the merger analysis, I completely agree with Rebecca. I'm not sure I would read too far into this case and say that there are, you know, there's clear indications that a court will go one way or the other. It's just, I just think there's just too much there to make any firm decisions on how this implicates the Meta case moving forward, or, you know, how to think through these problems just in general. So I actually very much deferred it to Rebecca, almost all of Rebecca's analysis on that, just because I just don't know if there is, it's even worth unpacking, because there's just not enough substance for me to chew on to be able to make an assessment one way or the other. In terms of remedy, I would expect a divestiture to be very much part of the conversation with respect to remedy. I mean, this administration, even with those comments, that the president has made it very clear that they are open to divestitures. And this, that was a very key part of the decision, the underlying decision of this case. So the question of, you know, how much influence does Google have on the publisher side of the market was certainly a big part of the tying arrangement. So a divestiture, I think, would have to be at least part of the conversation if you, with respect to remedy. I think it would be naive to think otherwise. I also think there's going to be a lot of transparency requirements. So one major criticism that the ad tech market has is, as Rebecca, I think even Bilal alluded to, is that it's happened, a lot of this happens behind the scenes. And so there's a lot of things that we really don't know. There are deals that are made. There are transactions that it's unclear, you know, who's setting the price, where's the floor coming from? Is the floor an actual, a natural, just as natural, organic, economic result, or is it manipulated by some of the algorithms that Google has in place in every aspect of the stack? The answer is unclear. And I think even the court goes into the opacity of the markets and saying, really, the reality is that you have these price-setting features that Google can avail itself to know where the floor is going to be and what the highest price is, and the competitors would frankly not have the same access to that same data. Is that fair? And so I think even Senator Mike Lee came out with a bill called the America Act, with, I think he partnered with Senator Klobuchar to address that issue in particular. So part of the conversation around that bill was actually apropos to what the conversation you had in this case, where Google itself during the trial described itself as a stock exchange, where, like, you know, we don't think of us as anything new or different. That's basically what we are. Of course, they backed off of that a little bit at the back end when they realized it wasn't working very well for them. But I would imagine that there you'll see some conversation and even some cues from things that Senator Lee has put forward with respect to transparency, and also maybe even impose a, I don't want to say a duty of care, but opportunity to measure conflicts of interest. And so I think part of it, I think absolutely there's going to be some form of conduct remedy that's going to be in play here, but you can't ignore the structural remedy as well. I think divestiture is clearly on the table. It was a key part of the DOJ's case. It seems as if the judge seemed very interested in evaluating that particular arrangement and may even be very open to exploring that divestiture remedy, but my two cents.
Well, Bilal, welcome your thoughts on, you know, on all that, including potential remedies. And in your answer, I'd love it if you could talk about, you know, how the court should evaluate, you know, ongoing market dynamics. It's a big part of the search case, you know, with the growth of AI. How should courts think about it in the ad tech space? And I'll just note, as I understand it, Google's revenue from placing ads, you know, its ad tech business has dropped for, you know, 8 consecutive quarters. So I think Google would say, hey, there's plenty of competition out there right now and it's growing. What are your thoughts?
So I'll turn to the remedies point in a moment, but I do want to comment on the merger, you know, the finding that the two mergers were not anti-competitive. I don't want to overstate the value of a district court decision on what may be a factual question rather than a legal question. But I think that the court evaluated those two mergers, at least as it wrote in the decision, based on the facts in the market at the time of the decision by the FTC to clear DoubleClick and DOJ to clear AdMeld, is something that works, that would work within the benefit of Meta, right? I mean, both their acquisitions, they were small players, definitely not in the same market as Meta or Facebook at the time. So I think that the courts looked at, you know, the merger acquisitions at the time of the merger and the conditions then is at least potentially a positive for Meta in the FTC case. On the remedies, first, I think both of these cases, to both search and ad tech, should settle. And I think DOJ is not likely to get divestiture relief in either of them, particularly in this case, you know, finding that the acquisitions were not anti-competitive. I think it'd be hard to justify divestiture. I think although this, you know, although DOJ has said, I mean, Gail said this just the other day, they want to stay away from regulation, which I would read as regulatory decrees. You know, this is a market where it's probably pretty easy to monitor discrimination or non-discrimination remedy, right? I mean, it goes to timing, it goes to visibility, it goes to ranking. So I think if there's a settlement here, or if there's an order of relief, it'll be something like a non-discrimination clause, right? And unlike other cases that don't deal in basically computer markets, right? You know, exchanges, you can monitor whether discrimination is or is not occurring. I also think, as you said, look, it's clear from Microsoft that it's a rule beyond just the DC circuit, that the remedy both needs to be tied to the finding of harm, right? And so I think that's another reason you sort of tend towards non-structural relief if there's going to be any relief. I also think the courts recognize they have to deal with the remedy as the market exists today. Sometimes that works in favor of the plaintiff, right? Where the market has become more concentrated and less easy to enter. You look for structural relief rather than behavioral or conduct relief. Here, you do see that entry is occurring. The market is changing. And so requiring a more relief, right? Relief that would address a harm, you know, from a market position 10 years ago is going to be overly broad and potentially make Google or Alphabet less competitive given the competitive conditions that are developing. So to me, it's either no relief or pure behavioral conduct relief.
Well, Bilal, thanks. And that's a great segue to my next question. You know, as the court is thinking about remedies, no doubt it's also going to be thinking about the policy impact of whatever it's going to do. You know, Google and the other tech companies, you know, are, you know, very much arguing that, you know, remedies should not be so severe that they imperil those companies' ability to compete internationally. You know, the president out there talking about, you know, the need to win the AI race with China. Let me ask you this question. You know, how, if at all, should both the Justice Department and then the courts, you know, evaluate, you know, these concerns about international competitiveness and, you know, the national security concerns as well?
Oh, I think that they should be very concerned about making our companies as competitive on the international market as possible. And that means exposing them to the strictures of competition. I mean, I think that the idea that the best way to compete against China is to, you know, sort of artificially prop up companies and give them insufficient incentives to compete and to innovate is just completely gets it backwards. So I think the good news is that, you know, international competition issues are aligned with the interests of consumers in the US. You know, work harder for our dollars, work harder to make products better for us. This is what we want, and it's what will make the next big thing. I mean, these companies started out in a competitive environment, and that's when they did most of their innovating. And then over the years, they have become less competitive environments and they have become less innovative. And so to me, it's just, it all sort of points in the same direction. As far as national security, that's a little bit different, I think, than the question of how, competitive on the international stage our companies are. And I have not seen anything other than just vague sort of flag waving of security issues, you know, like, so for example, I would expect that, you know, if the Meta case involved a divestiture, or if this case involved a divestiture, we might not sell it to a Chinese company. I mean, that sort of seems like common sense. But short of that, it's not clear to me how national security really plays into this, other than just sort of as like a general sort of scare tactic to wave that. So yeah, those are my thoughts. And as far as like the likely relief, I do think we need to be thinking about structural relief here. And the real, I would say one of the most important legacies of this case is that it's a vertical case. It is a case at bottom about vertical integration. Antitrust has for too long ignored the economic realities of vertical integration and how it hurts consumers in the long run. Not always, not in every case, but it's given almost a total free pass to vertical integration, even when it really creates real structural barriers to entry and creates real consumer harm. So this case takes a different view, and I think that it is the vertically integrated nature of Google that gave rise to the anti-competitive conduct. And so eliminating that vertical integration in this instance through a divestiture would be very closely tied to the conduct, as Bilal says. So, I think that's very much on the table as a possibility, and it ought to be.
Joel, would welcome your thoughts on this, of course. But let me press you a little bit on what some of Rebecca said. She commented that, gosh, you know, Google's not really innovating anymore. I think if Adam was here, he would say, well, gosh, Google and other tech companies are investing literally hundreds of billions of dollars in AI. Google researchers recently, claimed 2 Nobel Prizes. Is that a fair critique? Welcome your thoughts.
So there's a lot to unpack there, and I do appreciate the comments. But I think that there's two things. One is that the role of antitrust enforcers are to enforce the law, right? There are considerations that I think that the administration has gone through, and especially the Trump administration. It's not like they're not aware that China is, a threat. However, I don't know if that's a good justification for any firm to engage in anti-competitive behavior that violates our own laws. But I also push back on the notion that these companies, large tech companies, are actually our national champions. I don't think they even view themselves as our national champions. I mean, you look at Apple's relationship with the Chinese government, it seems pretty clear that Apple doesn't give any ways of how Americans feel, or even if they consider themselves as an American company. Google itself called itself an international company. They don't view themselves as like this pro-Americana company. And maybe that might change just because, the nature of political whims, but I am very skeptical of even remotely thinking that these companies at all have the American interests in their deep heart of hearts. So I'm not, and also on the other end, I mean, really one way to encourage a win in AI, if you really were talking about innovation, that's all happening with little guys. Little tech is actually doing more in AI than any of the big guys are. The big guys are basically have frequently demonstrated that they're slowing things down and gumming things up. And I think you'll hear that in Gail's comments. Gail's comments could go out of its way to talk about how the little innovator is actually leading the way. So, I fully appreciate that the big companies want to keep up, and they're definitely putting in investments, and that's important. They should do that. However, it just because you pay something down doesn't mean that you get a pass on being anti-competitive or slowing down little tech. So I'm just very skeptical of the claim that we need these guys in order to beat China. No, we really need our competitive markets to actually put forward really good products. And you're seeing that time and time again with little tech. You're seeing that little tech companies are like, even folks that who are funded by Y Combinator, which is overtly against big tech companies, have a lot of vested interest in there and a lot of money going into these little tech companies that are breaking that wedge in the Web3 context. So I do think that at the end of the day, what the antitrust laws and the antitrust enforcers should be considering are the facts at issue. I don't know if bringing in if a divestiture is the right way to go, I don't know if it is to resolve the anti-competitive harm. I'm not sure the value in thinking, well, how does this go to a broader anti-CCP or anti-China ethos? I just don't think that's helpful. I also don't know if that, especially if you're trying to quell one problem. And also, that's not up to the DOJ antitrust division to solve that problem. We have the Department of Commerce to figure that out. We have other aspects of the DOJ that are looking into these questions. I don't know if it has to rest on the shoulders of Gail Slater to figure out every aspect of international policy. Her job, as she said very rightly in her statement, in front of Congress when she was getting confirmed, was that she is there to enforce the law and focus on American markets. That is her job. That is what she's out there to do. And I think ultimately that is what she's going to focus on. And whether a court should be evaluating this, I'm as a constitutionalist, I I am very wary of a court engaging in strict policy decisions from the bench or using specific cases to make policy assertions that exceed the scope of what they're evaluating. So I'm very highly skeptical of judges sitting looking at the ceiling, well, as Justice Scalia would say, pondering, looking at the ceiling, saying, what should we declare the law to be today? I think what they should do, and what I think what they did here, especially in this ad tech case and the Google search case for that matter, was evaluate the case law at issue and say, and made, I think, a fair judgment call. And I think really what was happening here is that big tech has been demonstrated to be in a emperor has no pants situation, where we're like, I think all of us instinctually know that there's a problem in these markets, particularly with respect to search, ad tech, and the app store issues. And I think really the courts are coming along to that. And it goes back to my Trinko comments, where some of these more affirmative defenses are just falling by the wayside because they just are frankly nonsensical. But sorry, my firebrand is kind of coming out. Ultimately, I think that this
super, super helpful, Joel. But let's get Blal in there, and then we have one more question before we're at time. Blal, what are your thoughts?
Sure, thanks. And let me make one comment. I could see on the remedy, I could see some licensing as well as sort of a non-discrimination clause. Maybe there's some intellectual property that would support entry if they think some relief is needed. So I could see some licensing, you know, clone type effort, but I don't know if that's necessary. Look, I think the executive department's position in the FTC versus Qualcomm case is instructive here, right? DOJ may have taken a different position. The antitrust division may have taken a different position than the FTC in the Qualcomm case, partially because of, you know, Makin's view of intellectual property rights versus antitrust issues. But I think it's well known that people higher up in the Department of Justice, as well as in the other executive branch agencies like Treasury and maybe Commerce, maybe the National Security agencies and the Defense Department, were concerned about the monopolization case against Qualcomm, not because they gave, you know, not because they were concerned about the sort of no license, no chips problem, right? That could be resolved without, you know, without raising national security concerns. The concerns was, would the remedy in Qualcomm or the remedy here in Google affect Qualcomm's ability to compete with Chinese telecom semiconductor producers, telecom companies, right? Would it affect national security in a broader way than the antitrust case needed to be resolved? Here, the concern, I assume, is, as you raised it also, that Google is an important player in the AI space. People may believe it needs scale to be a participant in the AI space. The president clearly wants to win, you know, the AI race. And, you know, maybe a few months ago, we thought we were very far ahead of China. We're clearly not very far in advance of China. So I think that's, you know, what they're going to focus on, right? You can resolve the antitrust issue, right? I don't think we care if China is stronger than us in ad tech, right? Ad networks. What we care about is whether Google and other firms can support the investments to develop AI. And you know, I think at the margin, the agency should take account of that. But that really is not Gail Slater's call. May not be Pam Bondi's call. Maybe it's the Defense Department. Maybe it's the National Security universe. And that's just another reason I don't think you're going to get divestiture. They this administration believes in national champions in support of national security. And right now, Google is a major player in the AI space, and they are not going to fix an antitrust problem in a relatively small market in a way that undercuts Google's participation in the AI race. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Well, thanks for that, Blal. Look, I did want to ask, we're almost at time, but I did want to ask one more question about speech, which seems just integral to many of the complaints about the tech companies. So if I can ask you for maybe 30, 45 seconds on this question, Rebecca, starting with you, in her statement after the verdict, the Attorney General mentioned that this case would stop Google from censoring free speech. What do you make of her comment and the, you know, the relationship, if any, between this case and the speech concerns?
I don't think that statement makes any sense. And I don't think that this case has much to say about free speech. I think that the idea that big tech censors free speech has been a sort of way of bringing along different sides to the debate about big tech market power. I think that at a very abstract level, different tech companies, if facing competition, would provide different platforms and therefore maybe more speech options. But there's a lot of problems with that. Also, thinking about speech that way, that we need to have like different siloed perspectives. You know, we already have like Truth Social versus Facebook. So I think that unfortunately, antitrust has very little to say and to do about the censorship of speech. And I think that's just sort of political posturing.
Joel?
I obviously disagree. I think that online censorship is actually just a way to describe the actual consumer effect of this market concentration, when it's not actually all that different from some of the concerns that were raised within the newspaper market and all the ad market behind that. I mean, it's, the question is like, who has the money and who controls the concentration? And breaking up that concentration also could mean a net benefit for the consumer. And that would be, in this case, as Gail pointed out, potentially fewer instances of censorship. I think that's all she's really getting at. So I do think that there is a close connection. I don't think it's as tenuous.
Bilal, you get the last word.
Well, I don't want to criticize the AG. I think it is hard for me to see the tie between the alleged censorship and this decision, even a remedy in this decision that makes sense. But maybe they're thinking a little bit further afield and a few steps ahead of me, but I don't see it.
Well, guys, thank you so much for an excellent discussion. I wish we had more time to really dive in, but on behalf of the society, really, really appreciate it. And Edie, back to you.
Yeah, just to echo that, thank you so much to Professor Allensworth, Bilal, and Joel for their excellent discussion today. And thank you, Ashish, for moderating. We're super grateful for your time and expertise. And thanks to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate you tuning in. You can stay up to date with our other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.